us some feedback about what you wanted to hear about in the last three lectures, sort of various topics, and unhelpfully the votes, with the exception of one topic, the votes were so evenly split that it was like, you know, do you want A or B? Yes. I'm going to sort of try and cover aspects of the three topics that were sort of joint second place. But, you know, we'll see how it goes. So in these last three lectures, what I want to be trying to do is to sort of give you some pointers as to where formal gravitational theory is being used and what sort of techniques get used. So yesterday, we talked about Kaluza-Klein theory and did an explicit example of compactification with one extra dimension. And I want to sort of follow that up today by talking more about extra dimensions, but looking at it from a slightly different perspective. So this is going to be mostly about warped extra dimensions, but I'll probably put a little bit about brains in towards the end, if I get that far. So one of the things that we did see yesterday in reducing gravity from 5 to 4 dimensions was that I was very careful to keep units in there, to keep the gravitational constant and the length of the extra dimension. And so this is a sort of, I think I remarked on it at the time, and I want to pick up on this thought today. So yesterday, we had a factor of L when we integrated over the extra dimension. And so our 1 over 16 pi g became L over 16 pi g. And so that meant that we could associate our 4-dimensional Newton constant to the 5-dimensional Newton constant divided by the length. So that was in the case of one extra dimension. So we are getting a way, we're sort of coming to this idea that our gravitational coupling, if we have extra dimensions, is not fundamental, it's a derived quantity. And if we compactify at different length scales, we're going to get sort of different expressions for our 4-dimensional Planck mass relative to higher dimensional Planck mass. Wrong thing in my note. No, it is d minus 4 dimensionally. So in general, if we were thinking of having extra dimensions all at the same sort of scale L, then we would have a sort of volume factor L to the d minus 4 or L to the n, our co-extra number of extra dimensions. And that gives us some, potentially, some shift in the Planck scale. And so this idea was picked up on about 20 years or so ago as an alternative way of generating a hierarchy between sort of standard model scale physics and the Planck scale for gravity. So we could rewrite this. So I'm rewriting this to give an expression for the typical length scale of compactification. So what this particular rewriting does is it tells us that if we wanted to generate a certain hierarchy between our effective or observed four-dimensional Planck mass and some true higher dimensional Planck mass, it's a gravitational coupling, then what we have to do is we have to find an effective compactification scale, which, if we want to find it numerically in sort of our everyday units, we have this type of ratio. So here we've written it just abstractly in terms of the various mass scales. Here we've chosen a sort of fiducial mass scale of about the TV scale, and we've put in the relevant numbers to account for the actual Planck mass scale. So obviously, if we just have one extra dimension, this is not really going to fly, because we're going to need sort of a very, very large length scale if we want to have a higher dimensional Planck scale just a little bit above standard model physics. But if we have codimension 6, and we say we look for a higher dimensional Planck scale of around 10 eV, then our compactification scale is down at sort of 10 to the minus 13 centimeters. So this was considered a sort of attractive alternative to a resolution of the hierarchy problem, which is this vast disparity between sort of the quantum physics scales, the standard model scales, and the gravitational scale. Gravity is extremely weak as a force, and also, you know, problematic in terms of quantization. So this was sort of a, you know, the motivation behind thinking about what we call large extra dimensions. Now, that's not really large. It doesn't look large to us. But it is large from the perspective of the Planck scale, and it's large, or at least it's probable, from the perspective of standard model physics. So how can we make this sort of setup work? In Kaluza-Klein theory, or as it was originally imagined, the extra dimensions were curled up on the Planck scale, and so were truly invisible until you got right up to the quantum gravity scale. Whereas here we're saying extra dimensions are large compared to our Planck scale, small compared to our everyday scale. So so we can do this provided, to be consistent, provided we have the only way we probe the extra dimensions is via gravity. So a picture, if we were thinking about it from the perspective of Kaluza-Klein theory, if we imagine our lines of force coming out from a point particle, So the idea is that gravity sort of spreads out into the extra dimensions, but that weakens it from our four-dimensional perspective. So this only works if we are effectively four-dimensional. So this now leads us to a new question. Of how to localize our particle physics to four dimensions. Yes.
Should you take MD to be a descending model scale?
Sorry?
Why should you take MD to be a descending model scale?
So, no reason. I mean, so the idea here is that we want to, so we want to generate a hierarchy for the Planck, for our observed Planck scale. So it, that means that we would prefer to have a true Planck scale much closer to the standard model scale. So it's saying then that really there isn't this big difference between particle physics and gravitational physics. So we don't have a true, a genuine hierarchy. It's only an effective hierarchy. It's just a different way of looking at the hierarchy problem. It's got its own issues, but nonetheless, what it has done is, from a gravitational perspective, it's led to some very interesting alternatives for describing extra dimensions or higher dimensional physics. So, for example, when string theory was first sort of in its very first incarnation, it was supposed that the string scale was essentially sort of synonymous with the Planck scale, that all these extra dimensions were just curled up at an extremely tiny scale. You then did have issues and problems with trying to marry string theory with actual physics, such as cosmology, because from a cosmological perspective, extra dimensions have a habit of not being very stable. They either scrunch up or they expand out and decompactify. And so this whole sort of area of having a much more general perspective on how to deal with extra dimensions has led to some sort of really interesting and new ideas on internal manifolds, on stabilizing internal manifolds, new ways of using string theory in cosmology. And so it's that perspective. This is kind of essentially more or less where this started, thinking of the hierarchy problem and trying to solve it. So what I want to do is to use some toy models to motivate this idea of having large extra dimensions, yet having particle physics confined to some lower dimensional submanifold. So this is a course on gravity, so it's going to be more from a geometrical perspective. So I'm going to motivate via a toy model and I want to go back to that domain wall solution. Yep.
So you're saying that with six dimensions the scale is too big compared to our like Planck scale?
So no, here I'm saying that what we want to do is we want to have a higher dimensional Planck scale that's not too far beyond the electroweak scale. So if we wanted that, right, then that would tell us the size of the internal dimensions as a function of how many there were. So if you have only one or two internal dimensions, so one is, I think, sort of so, you know, of order solar system size. Two, you're getting down to more of like a millimeter scale. So then you have to ask, what is consistent with experiment? And if only gravity can probe the extra dimensions, then we have to think about experiments on constraining gravity. So it's gravity is actually, in some way, I mean, it's becoming more tightly constrained over the past couple of decades, precisely because people have been interested in these sorts of questions. But gravity is surprisingly not constrained in the sense of gravity on a small scale. Because it's such a weak force, it's very difficult to test. So we can be sure it's essentially four-dimensional down to a sort of sub-millimeter scale, but there's no way that we could check Newton's law at that sort of scale, you know, 10 to the minus 13 centimeters.
Yeah, everyone understanding those numbers, that's what we expect, or that those are what we want.
So if we wanted a higher dimensional Planck scale to be 10 TeV, then we would need the compactification scale to be 10 to the minus 13 centimeters.
What does that give you this order of magnitude for MD?
So that was the same question as before. This is just from the perspective of if you were trying to remove the hierarchy problem altogether, and have a Planck scale just beyond standard model scale, this might be a candidate number that you would choose. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying you have to choose it. I'm just saying this is a candidate scale that you could choose if you wanted to remove the hierarchy between gravity and particle physics altogether. So we know it's not at 1 TeV. I think we know it's not at 10 TeV anyway now. From the LHC. But essentially, it's just saying if we wanted to not, you know, just remove the hierarchy problem altogether or solve it via this geometrical perspective, that's just an example to pull out of a hat. I mean, it's a very extreme example. It's not particularly realistic, but it's trying to give, you know, the higher you make MD, the lower you get your Kaluza-Klein scale to be. So it's, but from the perspective of gravitational experiment, you can generate you can remove the hierarchy between a higher dimensional Planck scale and the standard model scale, essentially for codimension 3 or above. So it's saying that you don't, you know, if you have a few internal dimensions plus this, what I have to talk about, localizing physics on this submanifold, you don't actually need a very big compactification scale to generate a big hierarchy. So it's saying that this, the effect of the volume of internal dimensions actually brings your true Planck scale down quite quickly. So if we take, the reason we take 6 is just thinking from a string theory perspective. So with 6 extra dimensions, we don't really need a massive internal manifold to generate a convincing hierarchy. It's also, again, emphasizing that if you do have extra dimensions, our four-dimensional Newton constant is a derived quantity. So it's not fundamental in the way we usually think of constants like the speed of light as being fundamental. So remember, we had this domain wall that was a scalar field solution that interpolated between two different vacua. So now I want to couple it I want to imagine that that wall is our universe, okay? So I'm thinking of it in 5 dimensions. And I want to couple the field that generates the wall to a fermion field. And I'm going to give a mass term to my fermion field or rather I'm going to couple the fermion to my scalar field. So because our scalar field has this non-trivial profile, I have a different expression, if you like, for this mass, if you like. So my equation of motion So I just want to focus on the z-dependence first. So if I imagine I'm splitting off the dependence of my five-dimensional field into a sort of profile in z, and then eventually I'm going to introduce potentially four-dimensional dependence. So if we look first, focusing in on our z-profile, I can solve for a non-trivial profile in my fermion field. And this is my solution, provided or if I take my psi naught here. Provided that my residual psi naught, the sort of what I'm going to promote to depending on the space-time coordinates, provided that's chiral, so it has a definite chirality from a four-dimensional perspective. So if I now take this profile and say that this psi can depend on the space-time coordinates, so provided we satisfy our massless wave equation, so this is actually quite a sort of common thing. Yep.
Oh, what's the origin of the gamma 5 in the top equation?
So we've got five dimensions, so we've got five gamma matrices. So so the gamma 5 in four dimensions gets promoted to another gamma matrix in 5D. Uh-huh. And so we're kind of keeping our, we're sort of matching our gamma 5 to the Z coordinate because we want to reduce down to four dimensions or to think four dimensionally in the end. So we want our sort of gamma mu's to be associated with the lower dimensional space. And so we use our gamma 5 to correspond to the z direction.
So is it the same gamma 5 that we're familiar with?
Yes. Yeah. So we're sort of saying that, you know, our spinner has a very definite structure. You know, it has to be this particular eigenfunction in order to solve that equation of motion. And that results in the sort of residual four-dimensional dependence being having this massless form. So, I mean, this this type of behavior, if you like, if you think about what happens with the real scalar field, it was interpolating between two different vacua. But because it cannot be unwound, it is an alternate vacuum in a sense, because it is it is a non-perturbative state, you can't get rid of it. And so you can then sort of ask what happens if you have this new, it's not really a vacuum, but it's a pseudo vacuum because it's a sort of disconnected from phi equals plus eta everywhere and phi equals minus eta everywhere. And then if you have other fields coupled to your scalar that's forming this defect, then because of the profile of this background scalar field, it's, if you know, sort of in the core of the wall, you restore the symmetry that's broken in the standard canonical vacua. And so when you restore symmetry, what that means is typically the masses of other particles that couple to that field can change. So it may not be as obvious in this case, but if you think about the Higgs mechanism, so the Higgs develops an expectation value that gives masses to the gauge bosons, and we've got our standard model physics. However, if the Higgs had one of these sort of topological defects, one of these non-trivial states, which it doesn't, but suppose it did, then in the core of the defect, your Higgs would now have be in its zero state, symmetry would be restored, and you would have a very different theory of particle physics in the center. So because the fields that couple to your sort of defect-generating field can have different properties in the core, it means that the lowest energy state of those fields need not be constant. So what happens here is that the fermion, we say it condenses onto the wall. It's energetically favorable for it to develop this non-trivial profile. And the non-trivial profile is localized, not as strongly as the wall is localized, but it's localized on the wall itself. So this is a sort of quite a nice feature when you have these vacuum defects. And it generates an effective lower dimensional field. So that's the sort of, that's the idea. So you have your wall, you have a profile for, in this case, I've shown it for a fermion field, but because this profile is localized on the wall, but you can still get excitations that depend on the wall coordinates. So this particular toy model was actually explored in the 80s by Rubikoff and Shaposhnikov, and they actually wrote a paper which was called "Is Our Universe a Domain Wall?" So they were just exploring at the time ideas about, you know, these topological defects, which were, you know, we were trying to understand the physics of these solutions. So that's a very empirical description. It's actually not that easy to, from this perspective, to confine the requisites, sort of scalar, vector, and spinner fields on the, it's usually the vector fields that are the problem, to confine them onto a brain, but at least it motivates the idea. So typically, we kind of end up thinking more about a string theory perspective, in which case our surfaces or submanifolds are endpoints of strings, and endpoints of strings have gauge fields living on them. So, but this is a, it's a sort of motivation of why or how physics can be confined. So now I want to describe pretty much the only gravitationally consistent model with warped extra dimensions, and that is the Randall-Sundrum model. So this is a domain wall universe. And it lives in a five-dimensional anti-de Sitter space. So it's, again, a toy model. But what it's going to do is to illustrate how you get the sort of features about, of warped compactification as opposed to Kaluza-Klein compactification. So the first thing I want to do is to recall for us our full gravitational action. And something that David noticed when he was is that we tend to put root hk here, whereas of course because the first fundamental form is actually we've projected out the normal directions, strictly speaking its determinant would be zero. So just being picky, this is really like a root gamma, but because we are in the end, we want to associate our, we want to kind of have an interplay between what's happening in the full higher dimensional manifold, which we call a bulk, and what's happening in our lower dimensional boundary, which we call our brain, we keep the notation of H. So just bear in mind that if you want to be really picky, that H is zero, but what we really mean is the determinant of the non-trivial part of H. So when we did a variational principle, of course we have our boundary fixed, but now let us suppose our boundary is not fixed. So the whole purpose of the Gibbons-Hawking boundary term was to cancel off the boundary parts that came from varying our Einstein-Hilbert action, and we did integration by parts. So the boundary terms from integration by parts here are cancelled by the variation here. And what we end up with if you refer back to the Gauss-Kodazzi lecture, what we end up with is an expression involving the extrinsic curvature of the boundary. So here we've just got a bulk and one boundary. But
I
we can represent our lower dimensional universe, our domain wall, as two bulks with two boundaries. So this is a sketch of our domain wall. It's something very thin compared to our manifold, but we could represent this as two bulk spacetimes, which is just the space on each side of the wall, and two boundaries. And so when we derived this, our metric, we just had one space-time, we had a metric, and we looked at what happened as we went through the wall. If we want to think about it from this formal perspective of having a boundary of our space-time, we would have an n plus, an n minus, n plus, n minus, plus boundary, minus boundary, and that's what we would look at. So our sigma submanifold is going to be sourced by some energy momentum. Which is approximately a delta function. So when we did the wall, we didn't have a delta function. We had this such to the fourth, which was very strongly localized. But that's an approximation to a delta function. So if I think about this boundary prescription here, so here, what I mean is k of n plus plus k of n minus. So I'm imagining a variational principle for this full space-time here. I get bulk Einstein equations, which at the moment I'm not going to concern myself with because I want to focus what happens locally on the brain. So on this side, I get that Gibbons-Hawking term. And I get another one for this side, so I have to add those together. And then I've said that this is my energy momentum source. And so the contribution of these two surface terms has to equal my energy momentum source. So these equations have actually been known since the 60s, and they're called the Israel equations. And Israel got them by looking at the Einstein equations for a source that was like a shell and he looked at the dependence. So we had, when we did the domain wall, we had this sort of behavior. We had, if you remember, we had an a squared of z, gamma mu nu, dx mu, dx nu, something like this, minus dz squared. And we had an a double primed on a equaled minus 4 pi g t naught naught. That was what we had. So Israel did something a little more general. And he showed that you could integrate out through the core in a consistent, and let the width go to zero in a consistent fashion. So that's how he did it. And so typically, if you see this n minus here, the sign of that is flipped. And so what this means is that the Israel equations are typically written as delta KAB minus delta K HAB equals 8 pi G SAB, rather than this sort of averaging. So that we can consistently, with one codimension one, we can consistently let our source go to infinitesimal thickness. Why am I making a big deal of that? Gravity is a nonlinear theory. So what that means is you don't expect to just be able to send widths to zero and get something well defined because of the nonlinearity effects. But if you just have one extra dimension, this is the one case in which you can do it consistently, and it's the only case in which you can do it consistently. So from our Randall Sundrum, we have a wall in five-dimensional anti-de Sitter space, which is represented by sort of a very familiar looking metric, at least in form. We have a flat parallel metric. We have a normal direction Z. And then we have this very sharp, what we call a warp factor, took me a long time to be able to say that actually with a straight face, because when I first saw it, it just made me think of Star Trek all the time. But anyway, now I can say it with a straight face, warp factor. So here we have m plus has n plus is d by dz. So nz with its index downstairs is minus 1. And our k mu nu is just equal to the coefficients, the Levi-Civita components, parallel to the four-dimensional space-time. And so this is equal to got one minus sign there, one minus sign there, another one from the gamma, and another one from GZZ. So it's G mu nu, comma Z. Which is minus K, eta mu nu at Z equals zero. So it's Z2 symmetric. So my difference in extrinsic curvature is just twice the extrinsic curvature on the plus side. So my delta K mu nu is minus 2K eta mu nu. My delta K is minus 8K because we're in four dimensions. So my S mu nu which is the source, indeed has this property that it is just a constant times the intrinsic metric on the brain. So we saw that in the domain wall. And so here, you didn't like the hyperboloid of the domain wall, so you should be happy with this. This is a flat wall. Our wall lives in anti-de Sitter space. It's flat, and this warp factor, e to the minus 2k, z, is very peaked on each side. So this is why we call it warped extra dimensions. So it's completely the opposite of Kaluza-Klein theory. In Kaluza-Klein, we have that the extra dimension, nothing depends on extra dimensions. And here in Randall-Sundrum, it's essentially everything depending on extra dimensions. So it's completely the other way around. We don't have a killing vector now that's just d by dz because the metric has this extremely strong dependence on z. So that is the sort of canonical toy model of a brain with warped extra dimensions. So what I haven't yet shown for you is that gravity is sensible, even though we've got a higher dimensional space. But in order to do that, I'd have to talk about perturbation theory. So I'm going to come back to that tomorrow. And then just for the last 10 minutes or so, I want to talk about brains in more generality.
I have a question about Kaluza-Klein.
Mm-hmm.
What's the charge conserved related to the killing vector we found yesterday?
So going in the internal direction. So that's essentially electric charge. So it is like electromagnetism, yeah. Which kind of brings me quite naturally in some ways to the last little bit. Okay, so we can think of our wall as being a delta function source of codimension one. If we have codimension two, we have a string. So we can still, in four dimensions, we can still have a well-defined gravitational field outside our string. If we try and construct a zero thickness string, we can sort of do it, provided we have that type of effective energy momentum tensor. We do get a singularity, but it's a mild singularity. It's something called a conical singularity. So it's still something we can integrate. If we have codimension three in four dimensions, that's a point, and that's a black hole. So if we tried to construct a delta function source in four dimensions, this is where our non-linearity starts to come in, and we get the black hole. So we have this strong effect now in terms of space-time curvature. And loosely speaking, the reason for this is that it's only in four dimensions that gravity is actually a propagating field. So in three dimensions, gravity is kind of topological. We do have gravity. We still can have a sort of sensible set of Einstein equations, but space-time is only curved when there is energy momentum. Whereas in four dimensions, we can solve the vacuum Einstein equations and get something interesting, something non-trivial. As you go up even more, with more dimensions, gravity starts having even more degrees of freedom, and you end up with even more choices. So a codimension two object in five dimensions would be a string. So we can have a point particle would be a codimension three object. So in five dimensions, we have walls, we have strings, or rather we have codimension two objects. We then call strings actually something that has one spatial dimension, so that would be codimension two, and so on and so forth. So basically, we've got a lot more choices in terms of exact solutions. So our gravitational fields, our metrics, would look something like this. So let's just say we want the equivalent of a black hole solution in higher dimensions. So here, we did this for the Schwarzschild solution, where this was just dt squared, this was d omega 2, and we did have a b function sitting in front of there, but I don't want to have extra complication here. So this is now allowing our, if you like, a black brain, because we're extending our time direction. We're saying that we've got t and x and y. And this is sort of our transverse space. So we can use our Cartan formalism particularly effectively. You basically bring up what we did for Schwarzschild, and the structure is very similar. What we see, just going to give you the net result. Roughly speaking, this metric just talks to itself when in terms of the curvature two forms, and this one just talks to itself. We kind of saw that with the d omega two part of the Schwarzschild metric. So this we got for the d omega 2 part of Schwarzschild, and you see that you have to get something that looks the same for for the brain components. Then we have the mixture between the radial and angular or brain components. And then finally, we just get a cross term from the theta wedge theta part. So this is really just walking through the Schwarzschild computation and just seeing that, in fact, adding in all these extra potentially extra dimensions doesn't really change the structure of that calculation at all. So if you like, this is a building block for finding higher dimensional solution. So we can deduce our Ricci tensor and then solve depending on whether we're looking for a vacuum solution or a charge solution. So, just want to say a little bit about what type of charges we can have for higher dimensional solutions. So I know you saw this with Neil, a charged particle we represent by this sort of Lagrangian multiplier. We've got a charge Q, our gauge field A, and we dot that with the tangent to the world line. So we call a particle a zero brain because this is the spatial dimensionality of our extended object. If we have a string or a one brain, that's something with a time direction and with a spatial direction. It's a world sheet. So how do we get a charge here? Well, we have some sort of Q again, but now we have to mop up both the d by d tau as well as the d by d sigma part. So we can carry on and construct electrically charged brains in higher dimensions by having these forms, these multiple index antisymmetric objects as sources, as our gauge fields. So these are gauge fields in a more general sense. So that's sort of how we build up higher dimensional solutions. We can ask, what are the vacuum solutions, by solving the vacuum Einstein equations from that Riemann tensor. So for example, our higher dimensional black hole. I should call it rho after what I called. A high dimensional black hole looks very much like Schwarzschild, but just with a slightly different Newtonian potential, a different fall off. If we want to add charges, we can add electric charge to a black hole, or we can construct a black brain either by adding in extra dimensions here, Or actually, there's another way we can do this. We could simply construct a black brain by adding in flat extra dimensions and vacuum gravity. Because if I add in, if I imagine, you know, here I've just done it with two different composition, you know, composite sub sort of subspaces, I can add extra ones. And if I just add in a flat direction, you can kind of see if it's completely flat, if this was just a single dz squared with c equal to 1, it would not contribute at all to the Riemann tensor. And so this is an example of a black brain, which is a string in five dimensions. So tomorrow, I want to look at perturbation theory in general relativity. So we'll probably come back to aspects of the lecture today, in the sense that we've seen the sort of the bare setup of the Randall-Sundrum model, but I haven't convinced you it's sort of why it was so popular, you know, why it's sensible gravitationally. And also there are issues with some of these black brain solutions. So for now, what we've done is kind of looked at what happens when you've got extra dimensions, the fact you can get more interesting solutions, and also the fact that you don't need to have the extra dimensions corresponding to Killing vectors. You can have much more interesting internal manifolds that have geometry dependent on the internal directions.